Hey everyone, welcome back to the 343 Sparkcast. This is a very special Comic-Con edition of the 343 Sparkcast. We're not at Comic-Con, we're actually recording this ahead of time, but we're going to talk in the past as if we're in the future. Got that?
Yeah.
All right.
I have no idea what's going on.
Got some familiar voices already piping in, so I'm just going to go ahead and introduce everyone. Hey everyone, I'm David Ellis. I'm a designer here at 343 Industries. Starting to my left, working clockwise all the way back around me, is Frank O'Connor, Franchise Development Director here at 343. Mr. Kevin Grace returning after, I think, an 8-month hiatus on the podcast. I'm just making that number up, but I bet it's pretty accurate.
I've missed you so much.
Kevin, of course, is the franchise manager here at 343, otherwise known as Frank's right and left arm. Right? You just take care of everything.
Nice. Let's just go with that.
Yeah. So, and rounding out today is Matt McCloskey, who's the director of franchise business here at 343, which is your first time on the podcast. Welcome.
Thank you very much. This is the first podcast.
And if you've been paying attention to all the news coming out of the San Diego Comic-Con this week, you're probably sensing a theme for this episode. This week we're talking about, and I'm not going to use the code name of the project, Halo 4 Forward Unto Dawn, the live-action digital series that will be launching later this year on Machinima Prime and Halo Waypoint.
October 5th, to be precise, is when the first episode airs.
There you go. Mm-hmm.
And they will air leading all the way up to the launch of the game on November 6th. 2012 election day, remember to vote.
Rock that vote.
Vote often. Vote early.
I don't think you want to vote often. I think you want to just vote once.
Watch the TV, they said a lot.
So first off, I'm just going to, you know, obviously we put out the trailer. You've probably seen it by now. Actually, by the time we're recording this, I think it's actually 20 or 30 minutes after my first time seeing the trailer. So I'm actually still fresh in my mind reacting to it and everything. But I guess the first question I want to get out of the way is, why are we producing our own live action series? How did that whole thing come along? I mean, obviously there's been, Halo has a fantastic tradition of live action ads. Obviously there was movie stuff in the past. How did this all come together this time, this year, this project?
Sort of a mix of a bunch of things. We've done live action things for years now in the Halo franchise. They're always really well received. And the only complaint we tend to get is, there wasn't a story or it didn't go anywhere. It was just a sort of little vignette or a sort of snapshot of the Halo universe. And that was exciting to see, but I wanted to know about the story and the characters in the background. And so it certainly does that. And the slightly more cynical aspect is, of course, that it's, you know, this is the first numbered Halo sequel in a long time. And so we have people who are, we call them lapsed players, who either had the original Xbox and never got an Xbox 360, or maybe stop playing after Halo 3 or whatever, you name it, any number of things. And of course, people who bought a 360 after the whole sort of Halo thing had kicked off and never got around to playing it and had been playing other things. So we want to make sure that there's an easy on-ramp for those people to understand a little bit about the Halo universe and a little bit about the characters and history and background of Halo. And it certainly does that too.
We've also got a good story in there for people who've never played Halo at all, even just like, you know, science fiction, good stories. It's a way to get out some of the rest of the universe around the games. You know, we've been planning the stories, everything leading up to the launch of Halo 4 later this year, for years now in the novels and in live action like this. And in a lot of the stuff that's come from 343, we've been very conscious that all of the stories that we're putting out all feed into each other and kind of support each other and build a bigger universe for people to get into. And live action is a really great way to bring in people who aren't as familiar with video games, because everybody can sit down and watch a good story. And so that's what we're trying to do, is establish, or, you know, kind of demonstrate that the Halo has those kind of stories as well for people who are brand new to it. And then maybe if they get a little interested and they want to check out more about that awesome guy in the big green armor, we've got some other options for you.
It's actually good that Kevin, you and Frank mentioned the fact that we've been tying all these stories sort of together across different mediums leading up to Halo 4. We have a very difficult tightrope walk that we've been kind of following for the last several years, in that we're trying to create these stories that are completely standalone, super satisfying, whether they're books, comics, games, and now live action. How difficult is that to actually keep them completely satisfying for standalone, so you don't have a let's finish this fight conclusion? It's all wraps up within the story, but all things that tie into Halo 4 and the future of the Halo universe. How difficult is that to pull off?
It's super hard to pull off, but it's been a little bit easier since, not easier, at least we've had a plan since we, as Kevin alluded to a few years ago, just completely sort of flipped the bit on this. And instead of making them just standalone pieces, which is kind of what they used to be. Think about Halo Wars and Halo ODST and some of the books. But they didn't lead anywhere. They were designed to be safe, so they didn't interfere with the game. And that was cool, and it made for some really good stories and good universe building, but it was never really directly satisfying to people who wanted to see an arc or wanted to see the fiction spread its tendrils and really sort of embed roots back into the foundations of the fiction. So it's been really hard, but it's been a little simpler in a way, because philosophically you just have to say, well, this matters, so what happens to this guy next, or what happens to this scenario next?
Mm-hmm. And that's not, I mean, at all harshing on where the franchise started. I mean, because at the beginning, the first game, the first book by Eric Nyland, you know, who wrote a bunch of books and got a lot of fans really invested in the universe, and we wouldn't be able to do a lot of the stuff we're doing right now without those beginnings. You know, they didn't know that it was going to turn into 10 years later, we could have the chance to still be doing it. So we're very lucky that it kind of got that critical mass early and kind of kept rolling for the fans. But like Frank said, is that now we can plan these things. And so 3 years ago, we're having thoughts about, so what are we going to have Greg Bear do? What are we going to have Karen Travis do? What would we do in a live action sense when we're already planning on what's going on in the game? And so the aim is we can start all these different storylines and have them all meet together in Halo 4. And you're like, oh, now I know why that happened and that happened and that happened from all these other experiences that you've had in Halo. And now it means a lot more to you. Like you said, it's hard to do that in a way that doesn't require you to have read three books by Greg Baird to get into the game. But it's good hard, and it's
worth
doing.
Well, you're only going to be able to read two books by Greg Baird in the game.
Yes, that's right.
Third book's not happening.
Third book
after.
Is happening. Well, and you know, and so he's going to explain some things that happen in the game, again, to kind of keep that moving forward, because we're obviously not stopping at Halo 4. We got more games coming, and we got more books and more stories.
We talked a little bit about how this project came about. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that this project would not exist without. I think one of those is, of course, Matt McCloskey. Can you talk a little bit about your kind of influence on the project and how you came into working on Halo 4 Forward and the Dawn?
Absolutely. So, I mean,
that's a roundabout way of asking, what exactly is it you do here?
Who are you? Yeah, what do you do? So I often joke that the other people on the team make things and I make money. And all that really means is that I make money off the things that they make. But that's not
so we can make more things.
Everybody makes money.
It's the circle of cash.
Exactly, off the wonderful things that we do. But there are a lot of production challenges to doing anything in a separate medium or a separate product type than what you're used to, right? So we're a video game studio. We know how to make video games. We know how to license things out. For other people like Greg Bear to make great novels, we make a lot of toys, we have tons of partners. Most of those have been kind of licensing relationships. Halo Legends was probably the closest thing that we've done as a studio to kind of a separate product that we made ourselves and produced ourselves, as opposed to some of the supervision that we've done for novels and other products. But the franchise function that we have to supervise those, plus the production functions that we're developing as a studio, I thought gave us a fantastic opportunity to really get into some linear projects that we could really produce ourselves, and that we weren't licensing out to other studios or other companies, but that we could go down and find Hollywood talent to bring in the same way we've been bringing Hollywood talent across the entire studio for the benefit of the game and some of the incredible things we're doing with in-game cinematics. You know, we could do with live action and kind of take advantage of this spot that Frank was talking about in terms of the live action explorations that we do in advance of every major game for, you know, since 2007, we've been doing that. So I thought it was a fantastic growing opportunity for the studio to learn and expand and increase our capacity in terms of storytelling. And in a medium like live action, as Kevin was talking about, it's so accessible to so many different people.
Everyone can relate.
And, you know, everyone who works here, not everyone, but a vast majority of the people who work at Halo, I think love the brand, love the universe, love the stories. And it's always been kind of this private passion to give that to more people, bring more people into the universe, let more people know, because your enjoyment of the game, your enjoyment of everything, I think goes up exponentially the more you know about and the more you care about the characters and the events in the universe. So it was kind of that unique combination. My role really is kind of some long-term business strategy, and how do we think about taking advantage of opportunities in the marketplace? How do we think about expanding our production capacity and our capabilities as a studio, and this seemed like a great opportunity. So that's kind of was part of the initial push.
I actually want to come back to talk about a little bit more about that when we actually get into the production of the project, but I have to realize we are about 10 minutes into the podcast. We haven't really gone into detail, and obviously if you haven't, you should go and watch the trailer for Halo 4 Forward and Dawn. You can find it, of course, on machinima.com, on YouTube, Halo Waypoint. You can find it just about anywhere. And there was a panel at San Diego Comic-Con with some of these fine gentlemen and some other fresh faces and voices that you may not have heard from or seen before. But real quick, can we talk a little bit about what is Halo 4, Halo 4 Forward and the Dawn? I still get stuck on that every now and again. What's the story? Where and when does it take place? And how does it tie into Halo 4?
So it's set undersea and follows the adventures of a sponge who can talk.
Is there a crab that sings at some point?
Wait a minute.
There's a talking about sandwich shop.
Who would make up a singing crab?
Synopsize, Kevin Grace.
Synopsis incoming. So Halo 4, Forward Unto Dawn, as we saw in the trailer today, it really kicks off, the live action portion of it kicks off about 30 years before the Halo that most people have come to know already through the games. This is actually just a little bit before the first contact with the Covenant, and a very painful first contact, as everybody knows by now. And that the there's an academy there, which is an academy that the UNSC is running for the children of the elite officers of the UNSC. And the UNSC at the time is fighting a war against other humans. It's an insurrection. It's an outer colonies, outer planets versus the inner planets and Earth, and questions of why do we have to send you all of our neatest things just because you founded us? You know, I mean, obviously it's got some harkens back to America, independence, a lot of those issues. And as we get to know the cadets at the academy, one in particular, a young kid named Tom Lasky, he's got some real philosophical problems with this this fight. He's quite a capable student and soldier, but he doesn't believe in the cause. And that's a great big problem when your life is supposed to be dedicated among all these other cadets and all the academy and the family pressures and all that. So he's trying to figure out his place in this world and in this universe, going on and dealing with some other challenges that kind of come about in the story, both physical and philosophical, and is just about ready to call it a day when the war changes very dramatically and the Covenant shows up, and all of a sudden it's a very different war.
Spoilers.
Yeah,
what?
Spoilers. Well, I think as you just, you know, told everybody where to find that trailer, they know it by now. And young Vickers, great actor. What are those things? Indeed. Those things.
I know what he's looking at.
Yeah. Those, yeah.
There,
yeah.
There, those are hard
Frank.
Objects.
Those are Frank standing off camera.
Those are
the
scary
background.
Bad things. That's a spoiler as well.
What are those things? It looks like the last chicken at Safeway. Don't worry, kids.
It won't be fine at all. So as Vickers says in the trailer, it's a whole new war then. And Lasky and the other cadets we've gotten to know in the course of the show kind of have to figure out what they do in this very new world. Everything's changed. And I won't go into too much more than that because, well, that's the subject of lots of videos that are coming everybody's way.
So I'm not going to let you completely off the hook there. It's called Halo 4 Forward Unto Dawn.
Yes, it is.
Yet you said it takes place 30 years before the events of the Halo titles you may know and love.
Yes. Actually, the code name for the project was Sleeper. And
yep.
it was a play on a bunch of things. One of the things
I think I saw that on the internet.
Yeah. One of the things is that it actually does some slightly innovative bridging work between Halo 3 and Halo 4. There are a couple of characters from the old Halo games who will make an appearance in this, and at least one character from Halo 4 who's connected to their story very directly in this tale, and you'll get to see how those characters met and interacted and what that meant for the rest of the universe.
And we talked a little bit about that in the original press release that went out. The character of Thomas Lasky will actually, you know, in the future be serving on board as a leader on board the UNSC Infinity.
Good to get to know him.
And that's who you see in the last frame of the trailer.
Yeah.
So, yep.
Older Thomas Lasky.
Yeah. There's
wiser.
One other great big character, depending on how we define characters, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, we're now starting to see the fruits of the labors that have been going on for a good long time now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it'd be interesting to see. You know, I was excited seeing the trailer myself, and I work here, so I'm always fascinated to see how the audience is going to react to it. I think this is something that's it's shockingly ambitious, and I think that's something that I talked about a lot at E3 here at the studio. Sometimes we're very ambitious, but we try to tempt off. When talking about Spartan Ops, that's something that comes up constantly. And you mentioned, Matt, talking about providing a linear story experience and how that works out versus an interactive story experience in the elements of like a video game. And that's stuff that's very different. So obviously, we've worked with some really good people on this project. Can you talk a little bit about how we brought in the director and the writers for the project and, of course, who they are and where they come from?
Yeah, so project like this starts with a development phase, right? Where we kind of thinking about the direction we wanted to go. We kind of thought about the outer boundaries of the story we wanted to tell or some cool things. Actually, some of the initial cool story development came around thinking about those things that you could do in linear and live action that are harder to do in the game. So kind of take advantage of the medium in the beginning. So, and we were also looking at an incredibly short production time period and a very flexible model, right? So we needed people and producers and writers and directors who were willing to come and be kind of part of the Halo family and part of the Halo franchise and work with our franchise team and work within the canon and work within a lot of things that some people in Hollywood are not so used to doing. Mm-hmm. So it took a while to find the right people, but we started with actually our producers, Lydia Antonini and Josh Feldman, who kind of provided this fantastic nucleus of background. Lydia, formerly from Warner Brothers, she worked at the BBC. She has more of a traditional studio background, but within that studio system, did a lot of innovative digital work around what is the Watchmen and Batman and Peanuts. She actually did a lot of things.
Did she work on the animated motion comic?
She did the animated motion comic.
A friend of mine directed that.
There you go.
Yeah.
So Lydia produced that stuff, and then she also helped.
Lydia, pick that up.
There you go. You get that. Then she also worked on the Mortal Kombat piece that came out on Machinima about a year ago. And Josh Feldman has been with Playtone for many years. Playtone is Tom Hanks and Gary Geschman's
As I smack
production.
My lips loudly on the microphone.
There
Sorry
you go.
About that.
And he's also right now producing Electric City with Tom Hanks, which is interesting if you look out in some of the blogs of people looking at digital media and new productions. Halo 4, Forward Unto Dawn, and Electric City are being looked at as kind of these really interesting
it's pretty good
things.
Company to be in.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of that goes back to Josh Feldman. So we started with those two, and their job is basically to find you the right director, find you the right writers, and put together that initial package, that initial team that we worked with to put together kind of a standard product green light here at Microsoft to say,
I remember when that meeting was going on.
There you go. This is
one conference room over from where we're recording this one, if I remember correctly.
That's right. And so we interviewed a bunch of writers, we interviewed a bunch of directors, we found our favorites and the people that we thought would, do the best within the parameters that we had, and we're going to hit the quality bar that Halo has for all our products, which is extremely high, and proud of that. Wanted to make sure this hits it, and I hope you feel like based on what you saw today that I feel like it's actually exceeding our expectations.
I'm pretty cynical about these things in general, and I got goosebumps, and that's like my test for anything. If it gives me goosebumps, it's a keeper.
Excellent.
Yeah, that's why I smell his hair every time we hug.
Goosebumps.
Giving goosebumps.
Matt said something interesting there. When we were auditioning, and that's the process is you literally go to Hollywood and audition these people. We're auditioning writers and directors, and actually, the writers were kind of a mixed bag. Like they were all fantastic talents, but like some of them were just definitely not suitable for it. The Hellbings in particular made perfect sense because they'd worked on pretty high quality TV episodic stuff, and they were great at really instantly letting you recognize characters. They worked on Smallville and Spartacus and a bunch of other stuff. And so they were good at working in genre fiction and good at making characters really stick. The director was it was a tougher process for sure. But it was weirder because I think literally every director that we met was awesome. Like they all would have made great movies, but ultimately we went with Stuart A because we really gelled with him and liked his vision and his ideas, and they all, submitted their ideas for it. Mm-hmm. But Stuart was it was kind of like the rest of the project was kind of fit really well in our resource criteria, because what Stuart is really good at is making the most out of landscapes and people, and actually has done a bunch of horror stuff in the past. And the story that we were looking at was very, very much sort of had horror thriller elements woven all the way through it.
You're dealing with monsters.
Yeah, but we weren't dealing with monsters in it. You know, it's not going to be armies and armies of monsters. There's some really
much more personal
effects. Yeah.
Alien versus aliens.
Yeah.
Their encounters are the encounters of really young people with these sort of terrifying new, and that's their perspective, brand new monsters, right? And so making people have that fear of the unknown is really hard to do when you have a universe that's so familiar. And to be fair and blunt, brightly colored. Mm-hmm. And what Stuart was able to do was bring it back to this really dark place and this really scary. When you see that in the trailer where you see, it's not a spoiler, you see the footstep of a cloaked elite. And the elite is like completely invisible.
Yeah.
Right? There's no gaminess to that effect. It's like you're not supposed to be able to see him, but you can sense him. And it's going to get, there's some moments in it later on, even as they do get big and spectacular and explodey, that are still very much in some ways kind of a horror thriller sort of an atmosphere. And so that was the reason Stuart worked. But then, you know, maybe the hardest part, oddly enough, was probably casting the actors.
Mm. Well, yeah. I mean, we have a wide collection of actors. You have, of course, you have the cadets there at the academy, but you also have to cast someone to play Master Chief.
Yeah.
A big role.
Just one more more comment on the Hellbeans. One of the reasons we like Todd and Aaron so much is because they did so much research, right? I mean, they had read all the books, and they have a great story, which they probably told at Comic-Con as well, about when they were on the writer's strike, and there was something going on in the writer's strike and something in Spartacus, and they passed their time playing Halo. So, you know, people that knew and loved the universe and were getting into it.
Yeah.
And part of it was the Hellbeans came back and pitched us on a version of a story inspired by the novels that, you know, we loved. And we're like, wow, that's fantastic. That's not quite the right story that we're going to go with. But we love the fact that you guys dove into the novels.
You got it. Like, you could just tell they totally got what was cool about Halo and what was. And the weird thing is that this is mildly controversial, but the things that are really cool about Halo often aren't necessarily the things that are up there on the screen when you're playing. Because when you're playing, we're letting you do something, not watch something or be something or experience something. We're letting you do something. When you take that agency out, you have to find out, well, what's the core of it when I'm not in control?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the heart of this story when I'm not the person experiencing the story and I'm learning about these other characters? And that's what they really got in the treatment that they submitted.
And this is a sort of interesting trivia bit. If you happen to have come to the midnight launch event for Halo Anniversary down at the Microsoft store in Los Angeles, you actually might have met the writers because they were there that night. And that's where Frank introduced me to them for the first time, which was before the project was even fully greenlit. So it's an interesting tidbit. If you were there that night, you may have actually met some of the people who helped bring Sleeper to life.
One other thing on Stuart in particular is that he had just recently come off of working on another digital series called H+, which I believe
which
also had some news at Comic-Con. Stuart is fighting with Stuart over there, but did some great work on that. And having spent a bunch of time on set with him during the filming, it was very... he reinforced that we made the right decision going with him, with just how aggressive our schedule was and the budget and all of that, is that he was fast.
I imagine he had to be flexible as well.
Yeah, I mean, very flexible, but very, very quick. He didn't need 5 takes to get something. He needed 2 takes, or he needed 1 take, and he was right up there, right in it himself. He's not sitting back watching a monitor. He's literally almost on the shoulders of our director of photography, Brett Pollack, who... he and Stuart had a great relationship. It was a lot of fun watching them work together, not quite to the complete each other's sentences or thoughts kind of stage, but it was almost right there, which we honestly couldn't have gotten this shot
without
that. Those
guys were so efficient. They were so efficient. Yeah. Stuart was so cool on set, just keeping everything rolling and reinforcing his vision at the speed that we had to do was actually quite amazing.
Yeah, they ran a really good show. And to your aggressively... I don't know, exceeding expectations, I suppose, earlier. I remember, like, early on, our supervising producer, a very fine gentleman named Chris Symes, who they pulled in from a bunch of other Hollywood experience on working on Hellboy, Aliens versus Predator movies. So he's been around big features before. And he ran the first budget based on the script that was most of the way done for us. And I think he came in and said, you can totally shoot this at about 4 times how much money you have. That's how much money it's going to take to shoot this.
It was a factor of 10.
Was it more? Was it bigger? Maybe
whatever the number was.
My part of the story was,
10,
was when
it, Chris
we'd already argued him down some.
Does he get a commission based on how big the budget is?
No. He has been doing this for a long, long time, and he tells some awesome stories about going up mountains in helicopters and snowstorms to shoot for months at a time at night on Aliens versus Predator and crazy stuff. So just brought amazing experience for actually running the show. And keeping all the moving pieces working together.
There were loads of heroes. Like, I mean, there's some legends. Yeah, yeah. Our visual effects supervisor guy called John Sullivan worked on The Pacific and a bunch of other stuff. And he's really good at making...
He got an Emmy for The Pacific.
And he's really good at making like real places look like even realer places. Yeah. Like he takes landscapes and just
fills
them.
Which sounds ridiculous, but it's
totally... No, but it's
totally,
crazy. Like you see his process of layering in ships and clouds and smoke and battle. And it's just incredible. And we knew that was... something we wanted to get out of the environments because we need to make places just like Halo, places that feel familiar and literally in the case of Corbello Academy feel Earth-like on purpose so you feel grounded, but then you're able to
they
just
can interrupt
step
that.
Back yep. and it's and you're in this alien world. And of course Khazra, who we are all in love with.
Like, yeah, I was.
We all want to marry him.
We were just about to talk about Khazra.
He's our production designer, so he came up with the with very little. I mean, he got a lot of help from us, but he didn't need a lot of prompting, kind of like the Hellbings. Like, we never had to explain to them why a hunter was scary. And very much as a very similar way, we showed concepts from Halo 4. We showed the history of Halo to Khazra. And then the next thing we got from him was awesome. And almost without exception, we said, actually, no, that's good. And we can be a bit fussy about this because we know the fans, I mean, very... justifiably will be particular about making sure that the consistency is kept, but these guys got the universe and it just made everything else flow from there.
And a nice little tip of the cap and an homage if you saw the Master Chief in there. It goes back to the episode of The Package in Halo Legends.
And what's the reason for that, Kevin? Why would you use that version of the Chief's armor?
Because that's the version of armor that he had at that time.
It's set 20 or more years ago.
Yep.
Just reinforcing that.
That's all the pieces working together part is that is the armor. And we had a lot of discussions about that of do we use the modern day Halo 4 armor
so
to reinforce
familiar.
That for the new fans who just jump from that to the game. And so there are some objects in the world where we did take that approach. But in all of those cases, it's because fictionally it makes sense that they would have had different models of weapons or different models
or
that
things just haven't progressed
vehicles.
Very far
yes
in that,
yeah
they didn't need to
so we're tracking
M16 like hasn't changed in 50 years so
yep
you know
so,
there
yeah.
was because we're in software and video games and we make things on computers all day I think one of the most at least for me one of the most exciting and interesting parts of the production process was the carpentry shop and just the guys making sets right these guys actually make
did
things.
Any of you guys do what I did when I went in there I was like could you do this in my house could I have like a cryo chamber
so,
and like
wait,
a levitating
what's awesome
bed
here at the
we
studio
have
a couple of weeks ago we got some of the props from
the benches
so yeah if you're watching
tables by the way
space,
those benches
if you're
are
watching,
like 9,000 pounds
if you're watching Halo 4 Forward into Dawn there's a scene in kind of
a
cafeteria mess hall and we now eat lunch when the weather's accommodating here. At
that location has some of the best acting, actually, I think, in the whole
mess hall.
Which is, actually a really good transition. Kevin, you were talking about earlier being able to actually get things in two shots versus 30 shots. Mm-hmm. I think part of that is actually having a cast that gels with the director and the rest of the team to actually be able to put that together.
Yeah,
can you talk about
the cast went through so much. Basic training, just crazy.
Number one, a little call out to our casting director, Steve Brooksbank, who did a great job finding, you know, up and comers faces that could hit it and get into Halo.
A couple of veterans as well.
So. Yeah.
Veterans.
And people just blew us away. I think the young cast that came up and, you know, you just don't know quite the chemistry that comes together when you put everything and everyone in the same place. But they really gelled over the period of time, and I think their performances.
Well, we kind of ran them through, like Frank was saying, ran them through hell a little bit.
They actually went through a boot camp, didn't they?
So one of the other things we unveiled at Comic-Con, which is funny for me, is the visual ID, which is really the poster. That's what normal Earth people would call a poster, but we call it visual ID. So the poster for Forward Unto Dawn has, you know, it's of course heavily treated like film poster with this sort of. Photoshop montage of things and it's not takers but it's like of course it's Photoshop to put it together but the funny thing is that you look at Lasky and the Chief right
And Lasky looks really, really far too small compared to the chief. Obviously, he's not really that small in real life, and the chief is really that big in real life. Except that is actually a photograph. Yeah,
that's
and
not a Photoshop.
That is the size of those guys. Lasky is a normal sized dude, right?
No, he's a very appropriate size.
Yeah, very appropriate size. Our Master Chief actor, our physical performance actor, is huge. And that's really what we said.
So
give us
who
huge.
Was that? Who was in that
huge
armor?
And dreamy.
Can you talk about that?
Daniel Cudmore. I'll say that on a podcast.
He's been in a bunch of stuff, but he's probably most appropriately famous, at least, for being Colossus in the X-Men movies. Yeah. He's just made of abs and kindness. Right?
Oh, really?
That's his whole
he's
deal.
The biggest, nicest dude in town. Yeah. And I mean, I'm a healthy-sized human. Yeah. And every time I shook his hand, I mean, with or without armor, it was like I was shaking a grown-up's hand. I mean, I'm 6'1", 6'2", on a good day. And really, I felt like I was shaking a grown-up's hand. Like, I am way too small for you. Yeah. Except he's the nicest dude in town. He also is a huge Halo fan. So it was so nice that, like, coming on board, he knew who Chief was. He knows why Chief is awesome. He knows what he was getting into.
Yeah. It was funny because you see his takes on the – there's a sequence we call Sniper Alley, spoiler – and see his
spoiler
the way he
how
ironic you'd use that term
but the his physical performance in that, even if you look at his first takes, the way he's shooting, like, is just straight out of game, right? He's owning the chief's sort of strafing point and shoot mentality, and he's just being
and that suit cannot be easy to move around in, and yet you see him doing some really incredible
or get in and out of, as
that
I had witnessed a few times.
Why did you try it on at one point?
No, that would have been
poorly.
But
we made him do a photo op for one day, and then I felt so bad because that was the first time I'd seen the process of how long it took to get a suit on, and it was like, we're not making
how much baby powder is required to get him.
It was like 45 minutes. It's 45 minutes getting that suit because it had lights and fans and
the fans don't do enough.
Yeah. It was crazy complicated
and
suit.
I felt bad. He said, I mean, he's no stranger to doing this kind of work working as a predator, working on Colossus sand suit. But he said that these kind of suits from doing it before is that after the first few days, about a week into it, the suit starts to kind of flex a little bit. You kind of wear it in like a pair of jeans, except it's, you know.
Let's be honest. It starts to smell a little bit.
Well, so there's a little bit of that. But in this case, we ran him through so much in the combat scenes and the stunt scenes and the warthog scenes that he actually basically blew out the undersuit. And so they had to make a new squeezy part of the suit that he had to then break in again. So he went through suit hell twice for us.
But here's the thing I loved about. So Legacy built that suit, the same guys that did the Iron Man suits. They do fantastic work. And that was custom for Daniel. That was Daniel's suit. They literally 3D scanned him and then did some version of 3D printing to custom make the suit exactly to spec. And actually, when you actually look at the boot, they got a size 14 combat boot and cast it into the armor. So
I wear a size 14
combat boot.
Just putting
you
that
fit
out there.
In a size 14,
ladies. So that's, this audience, lady. Yeah. I mean, mom. I'm sorry.
So if you happen to be, 6'8" and 225 and exactly, if you happen to be Daniel Cudmore, you can fit perfectly into the suit. But
one of a kind.
One of a kind. Absolutely.
So, talking a little bit about the production, talking about a little bit of the action, the warthog sequence, people who got a chance to come to E3 down in Los Angeles this year actually got a chance to see the warthog from the production of Halo 4 Forward
Under Dawn. In its Forward Under Dawn dress.
Can I clarify something on that?
Yeah, absolutely.
So after E3, I kept waiting for someone to look at the logos or something that was on the warthog on the floor and start speculating about, because they're the Corbulo Military Academy.
It's the general's. It's actually the general's car.
Correct. It's a general's car. And one of the only things I saw on it was on Kotaku was a series of photos where they said, well, it's not the Weta Warthog that actually drives and works like a warthog, but it's a really convincing replica. Yeah,
but it was, in fact, the Weta Hog, and it was covered in vinyl skins because we had to protect the real paint job, but we also had to make it look like the general's staff car. So it was, in fact, the Weta Warthog.
And you see in the trailer, does drive.
Yeah, the Weta guy, the guy, they have a guy whose name escapes me for the second, but I'll remember it immediately as soon as the podcast is over.
Pete. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Pete. Sorry. Ripper. No, that's Australian. No, you're mad. I did that on purpose. Sorry, Kiwis. That's the Weta driver, stunt performer kind of, and also mechanic. Like, so he does the whole thing.
It's very difficult to drive.
Yeah, it's incredibly difficult to drive, as Curtis Creamer found out when he smashed it straight out of a warehouse the first time he turned the steering wheel. And but it's tough, as he also luckily discovered. It comes with he brings spare axles, front axles for it, because it's four-wheel steering, and these things are really tricky and complicated. So you always see these spare parts laying around it. But he was a sweetheart. I mean, he was just
Fantastic. He was here last year for Halo Fest. Yeah, he's fantastic. Just fantastic about answering questions, anything, all that stuff.
And by the way, he told us that that Weta Warthog had been, you know, it's stored. We bring it out for marketing occasions, etc. But since the landfall piece, or since the piece that it really had not gotten anywhere near the workout we put it through.
Yeah.
And we put it through several harsh nights of gravels in the dark.
There were times where people,
you
were like,
explosions.
They were just tearing around and no one was filming as well. You're like, wait a minute.
We're doing prep work.
Yeah. Well, so he really liked it, because he was really proud of that the Warthog was really getting.
Oh, and you'll see the stump driving in the piece. That is thing is tearing around. It is. Yeah. It drives like a warthog.
Well, in the clip that from the Machinima panel, I believe earlier on Thursday, which is that going to be up?
Yeah. That's live.
No, it won't be live yet. They will have shown it at the panel.
Okay. It will be live to someone.
Someone will have filmed.
Nobody will film a panel and put it on YouTube.
Comic-Con?
That does not happen on the internet.
Well,
Yeah. That's so true. It's up there. So anyway, just a little taste, but there'll be more of that coming later on, because that Warthog was a lot of fun. And the line of, ooh, can I drive it, was long. And the line of, ooh, yes, you can drive it, was very short.
I think an interesting thing to point out with the series is that, you know, it's running almost like a mini series, basically weekly leading up to the launch of the game. But of course, we've mentioned previously, when you purchase the limited edition of Halo 4, which, being the smart consumer that you are, you absolutely will. It's going to come with an extended version, basically as a movie rather than a miniseries, where everything's cut together, you know, over 90 minutes, tons of behind-the-scenes stuff, some of which, we've seen a little bit internally. It's
And Matt and a couple other people went down to L.A. to watch the first rough cut, and we saw it in a couple of pieces, but it was, like, largely sort of put together. And we're supposed to go there and take detailed notes and just watch it and pay attention to granularity and stuff, and I got like 15 minutes in before I realized I had stopped working and was watching
critical
it for
thinking.
Fun. Yeah, I was like, this is awesome. I wonder what happens next. Like, we know what happens
next. You anyway. Tried it.
But yeah, it was fun.
It was good. Yeah, so by the way, on the five episodes, they'll be running about 15 minutes a pop.
Yep.
And so then when you get the Halo 4 LE and you watch the what we're calling the special edition of Halo 4 Forward Unto Dawn, it'll be basically a sixth episode worth of content, but it's woven throughout the cut. It's actually a different edit entirely. So I think people will enjoy sitting down and seeing the whole thing.
Watching both, importantly. I mean, that's one of the things. We wanted to make sure there are no barriers to entry for this. And one of the reasons we worked with Machinima is because they're a great partner, but B, they have... They're one of the biggest YouTube channels, basically. So you can watch at Machinima Prime on basically just about any device and with very few limitations. And eliminating barriers to entry is half the point, right? We want to expose people to the Halo universe without forcing them to go buy our game first, because that would be stupid if they're not interested in it.
Yeah.
So this is a way to give them a soupçon.
And of course, it'll be available on Halo Waypoint as well, as usual. Yeah, so. Any other stories about the production? We filmed this, of course, up at Vancouver. You may have seen some pictures online.
Might have.
Yeah. As it always does.
Courtesy of Simon Fraser, University's PR department.
Well, and the local folks who were nice enough to take actually quite nice pictures.
Some of them were really good. There was a great photo of Chief standing on like a bridge with like an explosion behind him. It looked like a White Snake video. Yeah. It was pretty awesome.
I'm not sure White Snake is exactly the bar.
But David Ellis
we
is wearing a negligee and resting on the hood of the Warthog.
Nice try. No one's going to Photoshop that.
I need to go wash my brain.
It's already done.
Vigorously. Production was, we had about 5 weeks up in Canada, up in Vancouver and Burnaby, Simon Fraser University, and
on set, of course.
At the university, and then on the sets that we built in the shops that Matt mentioned earlier. Had a great crew up there, the rest of the cast, and it was nice. We kind of alternated people from the franchise team here, so we had a lot of people. One of the guys who is doing a lot of the writing on Halo 4 was going up to kind of sub in and watch the details, and Jeremy, who is a known Halo long-term historian and
AKA Mr. Vociferous
Standards Keeper. Exactly.
He AKA was up there for a real life Spartan.
Yeah.
He just exists in our world.
Yeah, a little bit. So it was great to be that close to 343 just to be able to pull people up when we needed things. But it was a great learning experience for us to see how all this goes. And we keep getting told that we are getting way more than we should have gotten for the amount of money that we put into it and the amount of time that we gave everybody. But everybody came together just marvelously. And it was, for as crazy as it was just an awesome 5 weeks.
So you all have to have some crazy story from the set. Has anyone got some crazy stories you haven't
Did
told?
Did anything blow up?
Nothing. Lots.
Hilarity. Unintentionally.
Yeah. Okay. So here is, and I'm a bad person, and Brett Pollack, I apologize for this. He's our director of photography. He might be. At some point in time, somebody will tell him about it, and I still feel bad about this. It's like the last shot, literally the last shot of the show. Brett is wearing this crazy getup to be, there's a scene in there from Chief's perspective. That's not too much of a spoiler. But to do that, he had to cobble together this crazy homemade rig of a camera on top of a helmet, on top of a vest. And he's watching a monitor so he can't watch his feet. And he's running through combat rubble. And there's Marines dying to his left and to his right and in front of him and all this stuff. And he's in a, and then we turn the lights off and we fill the place with smoke. So he's watching a tiny screen looking up into the sky, wearing 50 pounds of rig on his head, very expensive rig. And they come and talk to me about where he was holding his gun, like compared to what players are used to seeing. It's Chief's perspective, so it needs to look like it looks in the game. And I had just been marveling because Brett plays a buttload of Halo, and he had just, for in a spare moment, he kind of did an idle animation, like just out of nowhere. He held the pistol up, he turned it over, he shook it, he checked the screw like that. I'm like, seriously, dude, that's ridiculous. But they asked me, it's like, where should the gun be? I said, a little higher up. I said, yeah, a little higher up because it's not quite enough in frame. And then I turned to one of our other producers and said, man, I'm a jerk because he's about to run down a dark hallway filled with rubble, can't see his feet. And I told him to hold his arms higher up in the air. And pretty much as I finished saying that, he hits one of the Marines, I think, and completely turfed. And so the screen does this precipitous topple over and we see nothing but floor and his hands spread out. And there's this huge intake of breath from everybody. And then he pulls back one of his chief gloved hands and gives a thumbs up on screen. And like everybody laughs. And I am a complete monster for making him do that.
That shot has to go out to public now.
But he was great. And he got right up. I think I was more worried about Brett. Some of the people were more worried about the camera. But both of them came out okay. But that was right at the very, very end of the 5 weeks. And it was hard saying goodbye to everybody because we had a lot of fun together. But hopefully once the show comes out, all that work and all the effort that everybody put into it will be evident, and fans old and new will like the show.
And big shout out to the production crews in Vancouver. I mean, the talent the carpenters and the producers.
Well,
and
they
the
did get a sweet sweatshirt out of the deal.
They got a super sweet sweatshirt. Super sweet sweatshirt out of the deal.
Five times
But
fast.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons we could do this is because there's such an incredible base of production talent up there that you can go in, and these are guys that have worked on all these movies up there and great sci-fi TV shows and TV series for a long time. So,
and both Kazra and Chris fantastic. Both pointed out like that they've worked on a lot of things, like the quality of set building and
the
prop
sets.
Building they would said were amazing ridiculous.
Was as good
and I've
as,
been yeah I've been yeah. on a lot of sets. I have to say that like even in the stressiest parts of it, that was one of the nicest, that's probably a Canadian thing, right? They're probably sick of hearing it. It was one of the nicest sets that I've ever
very
visited.
Polite.
Oh my god, yeah. You don't have like someone screaming at you to get off the show.
Well, good planning and good focus. Which we had to have because we didn't have time.
Otherwise, this would not have
for happened. For O-Craps. Yes. If we have like one O-Crap, we're in
an exciting three-episode miniseries.
So.
An exciting trailer.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up. You guys have got a busy week. You saw the panel. We're there.
Future,
we just got back from we're still at Comic-Con?
No, we're still at
Comic-Con.
Where am I?
When am I?
We're still at Comic-Con. And, of course, we have another panel. If this goes up on time, if not, this is going to sound weird. We have another panel going up
no pressure, Ellis.
Saturday afternoon at 3:15 p.m.
Halo 4
all up, talking about campaign, talking about Infinity multiplayer experience. Should have some goodies there as well. So, this is really kind of just E3 was kicking off in a lot of ways. the marketing
through
for kicking through.
What's a continued kicking?
I don't know. I believe it's a bruise.
Let's keep moving.
Yeah, so we're gonna keep going. We have a lot of exciting stuff. Of course, Halo 4 Forward and Dawn coming out. We have panel later this week, Comic-Con. We have lots of exciting new stuff coming as we get closer and closer to that November 6th launch day for Halo 4. So we're just several weeks away from locking the game down. So it's a pretty crazy time here at the studio. So thanks everyone for taking time out of your busy schedules to join me on this and put this together for the fans. So
thank you, sir.
Yep. Until next time, we'll talk to you later.
Peace.